Welcome. Today is 7th of April 2009. In Sanskrit, a lot can be said with very few words. In English, you need a lot more words. And when I do a translation, I will put more, even more words in, so you'll know, because there's a frame of reference that this is coming from. There's a backdrop. And if you know the frame of reference, then, you know, I wouldn't have to put a bunch of stuff in. And, but if you don't know it, then what? You know, who are these people? What are all these names? They're foreign names to begin with. So if you're not familiar with the frame of reference, you know, when you study the Vedas, Kalindi pointed it out the other day, there's a whole frame of reference. You know, well, who's Indra? Because, you know, they talk about Indra a lot. Well, who is he? Or is it a he?
The
winter
god?
Hmm?
The wind god or something?
No, he's...
People can just start reading and they're calling...
Yeah, he's the...
Like Radha and Indra and Krishna. And
he's the rain god.
Prahaspati, and you're like, who?
He's the rain god. And he's the king of the gods. So anyway, yeah. That's the answer. Okay. Saturday... Was it Saturday? Tom Brady and Gisele Bündchen got married.
Today?
Yeah. I thought Tom Brady is with that actress, Bridget Moynihan.
I
didn't
even know who Tom Brady is.
Tom Brady is a quarterback for the New England Patriots football team. They're from Boston.
Right.
He's big, big football star. I mean, he's a major player.
Well, that's good news, because she's clearly way out of Leonardo's way now, so he can be mine. Just in case they were ever going to get back together.
Well, that clears that up, doesn't it? So, the reason I brought up the wedding, I'm not sure if it was Saturday. I think it was. They got married in Costa Rica. And, of course, it's a private affair. But they would be hounded by the paparazzi, those people. I don't expect you to know who Tom Brady is, but I think you would know who Gisele Bündchen is. And I don't know how it all happened, but the photographers, there were two paparazzi photographers that were there and trying to get some photos. And the guard, they have bodyguards naturally, or guards for their wedding. The guards approached and said, give me your cameras. And, of course, they don't surrender their cameras, right? He said, give me your cameras. So they ran away with their cameras. They jumped into the SUV, as you guys call it, the Jeep. And the guard shot out the back window, and the bullet whizzed right between the two of them out the front window. So nobody got shot.
Oh my god.
But there was shooting. So on Saturday was Moon and Ketu. Right? Moon and Ketu together in the sky, which really destabilizes a situation. Because Moon is water, I call it. And Ketu is fire. And Ketu brings in that crazy, unstable, unpredictable, somewhat mad, out of control feeling. Or circumstance. Oh my God, what am I going to do next? you know.
Well.
There were. I'm not sure. You're right. I'm not sure. Was it Saturday? Yeah, it was a busy weekend for gun-toting crazies. Immigration.
Yeah, he went into the social welfare. Was it social welfare?
I think it was Friday.
Oh, yeah, the immigration. Yeah,
the immigration. Yeah.
The Korean guy or Vietnamese guy.
Yeah. Vietnamese guy.
Yeah.
And killed a bunch of people.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would have been the moon in. That was Mooncake too, also, that day. Moon is mind, emotions, mental outlook, or no mental outlook, lack of. On the monthly planetary planner that is available on the website, it would be listed as a gray day, because moon is afflicted by Ketu, which is a natural malefic or malevolent planet. And so that, therefore, it would be a gray day, even though the moon is in Cancer, was in Cancer, its own sign, which would normally be a silver day. Moon in Cancer would be a silver day, but because Ketu is there, he's the party spoiler. And as we've said, using the planetary planner, don't really do. Avoid doing important things on gray days as far as possible. Marriage might fall under that category. Yeah. So even though Venus in the sky right now is exalted, as powerful as it can be, and Venus being exalted is absolutely, in most cases, a wonderful time to get married, and you know, could assure a long, very, very loving relationship. But in this case, with the K2 moon, it means somebody in the marriage either is or will be mentally unstable.
But is it more likely to be her because it's the moon?
Not necessarily. That's a reasonable interpretation, because the moon is feminine, and you know, the sun would be masculine, the sun would be the man, the moon would be the woman, is what she's saying. So it's cases with the moon are likely to be the woman. You know, it's a reasonable interpretation, but you couldn't bet on it, because it could be him.
Could be his feminine side or something.
Yeah, well, it just could be him.
So that he is already in...
Well, we don't know. You see, they could already be people who behave like that, or it may come in the future, because things happen later on in people's lives that there's no sign whatsoever. Yeah, have you ever heard anybody say, if I would have known they were like this, I never would have married them? You ever heard that before? Countless times, you see. So when you calculate a time for marriage, which is so important. Did I say so enough times? It can help you determine. I don't mean it can control everything, because it can't. But it can help you. It can play a role as a determining factor for how your marriage or your event or your project or your business is going to evolve over time. And a marriage especially, because it's so intimate, and it's so you're with the person a lot, you know. Roll over in the middle of the night, guess who's there, you know. That's the way it is. It's very intimate. I mean, you better want to be there, and if you don't want to be there, it's not a good place to be. Paul McCartney and Heather Mills, if I remember correctly, got married with a Moon Mars conjunction, which is somewhat similar to Moon K2. Why? Because Mars behaves a lot like, K2 behaves a lot like Mars, because they're both fire, elements. Mars doesn't have that sort of crazy thing that K2 does. So let's be clear on that. But Mars has a lot more of the fire and the anger and the resentment, the overreaction. K2 can bring the overreaction. Have you heard, how many times have you heard somebody shooting guns at a wedding? The Muslims, the fundamentalist Muslims, like to shoot guns in the air. I've noticed that it's quite popular. And in the Arab countries, they like shooting guns as a celebration. But it's not at weddings, you know, you don't usually. But again, that's, you know, that's K2. Anyway, McCartney Mills got married, and that was a Moon-Mars conjunction, correct? Remember that? And the first 2 years was a major period of, or a minor period of Rahu. And then let's just say the marriage turned the corner. And shortly after the two-year mark, when, whatever it was, when they went into the Rahu minor period, they separated. Almost immediately. And alienation grew. The falling out. And by this time the girl had been born. The baby, the girl. And then it got very... there was a lot of animosity and anger that came out. Moon Mars. So I hope for Tom Brady. I am a football fan, American football, and Tom Brady is an exceptional football player. You know, New England Patriots, and you know, I hope that their marriage works out okay, and that I'm absolutely wrong about what I've. But what I think is going to happen.
But it also depends on their charge and their compatibility to each other as well.
Yeah, but the marriage chart is...
It's crazy that
it has very powerful effects.
Sort of like divine timing anyway. Everything just falls into place because it's supposed to. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, it's like saying, we're all going to go for a nice picnic on Saturday. There are going to be gale force winds, driving rain, hail, but we'll have a brawly. We'll have an umbrella, and there's a nice picnic table. But all of our charts are compatible, so it shouldn't really bother us. I'm just giving an example. I'm being a little silly, but you see, no matter how compatible we are, how much we get along, how much we may like to have this picnic, it's not going to be pleasant because there's another.
I back the brawly.
I would love it to go away.
There's another force in operation. You see, you'd be gone like Mary Poppins. You'd be doing the chim chiminy, chim chim tree. She'd be doing the guy tree, bringing out the sun. She likes to bring the sun out at will. I had a good point there now. Gone.
You were saying about compatibility of charts.
Yeah. No, something else I was thinking. Anyway, a marriage is an entity unto itself. As a business is an entity unto itself, but definitely a marriage. You have you and you have your mate, but when you get married, that becomes an entity. And there's no more I, it's we. It's us. There's an I, but the I can't really eclipse the we. Well, it shouldn't. You know. And so this third entity, which is the marriage itself, has its own birth chart, which is the time of the marriage.
Yeah.
And don't think it doesn't have a tremendous effect, because it does. That's the point. I'm going to mention this. The British Association for Vedic Astrology is having their annual conference. If you're all interested, the 11th annual conference, 2009, in London. And this subject is business and financial astrology with leading international experts in the field. 16th to the 20th of April, 2009, Bond Street, Mandeville Place. Speakers are the world's most respected experts. Drew Lawrence, Barry Rosen, Phil Anderson, Prussian Dutt, Alex Lubenskis, Camilla Sutton, Andrew Foss, Jeffrey Pierce, and Gordon Brennan. So I'm going to be giving three presentations at that. Thanks. So there's the plug. It's official. I read something very compelling the other day. As we've talked about repeatedly, according to Vedic understanding, there are three levels of God realization. According to Eastern philosophy or yoga philosophy, most people, the vast majority of people, are familiar with the first one, which is God as energy. So this is Brahman or Holy Spirit, spiritual energy that pervades everyone and everything, sort of like sunlight. But sunlight you can see. Brahman, which is what it's called, you can't see. Not with these eyes. You can see it with this eye, third eye. And the goal of certain practices and disciplines and beliefs is to merge into Brahman. And many of them say that this world of diversity of names and forms, and this is all illusion. And God in the highest manifestation is only energy and no form, no individuality, no kinds of distinctions, no objects, no persons, no individuals. That's what you will find on the first level of God realization. So if you really, jokingly I say, if you really don't like being with yourself or hanging out with yourself, if you don't like being a self, if your self isn't appreciated by others, what to speak of by yourself, then losing the self or giving up the self, the sense of self, the individuality, what speak of the ego, can be, in many people's minds, a great blessing. Just to merge. I am God, you are God, we are God, we are all God, everything's God. That is the first level of God realization. Those who believe in a personalist philosophy, such as yours truly, and my guru, who taught me about this, what I'm telling you, and accounts that I have, things I've seen, observed, read, people I've known, it gets boring up on that platform after a while, because you're not really doing much. You're just being here.
Just like sitting down and just trying to meditate.
Yeah.
Numbing your brain.
And you can go into that transcendental state, which is wonderful. And then what are we going to do? Okay. So I spent a little more time on that than I had planned. Now, the second level, first one is energy, next one is diversity. And that's to see God in everyone and everything. It's easy to get the sense that, not easy, but relatively easy to understand that you're divine. And everything, you know, God's energy pervades everything. To look at somebody else, especially somebody that you don't like, or a group of people that you don't like, or a certain person that you don't like, or an ethnic group, or make your list. And realize that they too are parts and parcels of God. And that's not so easy. That's when it gets real difficult.
It's easy to realize that somewhere in there is God, but you still don't have to like all the layers.
No, you don't have to like the people, but you have to be compassionate and understanding. That's what I'm getting at.
The Buddhist meditation technique, mindfulness meditation, focuses on that. Is that what?
No, I haven't. I mean, that's part of that, certainly. But this is the thing that I discovered this week. And just to, before I tell you about it, the third level is personality, seeing God in personal form, face to face, in relationship. Just like we're seeing each other now. So that's meant to be the highest level. So you have a relationship with God, as we have a relationship. Now, what I read was, the way to grasp this second level of diversity and develop compassion is by something we've all heard, is meditate on God in your heart. So when you meditate, you feel, see, sense, picture God in your heart. You know, whether you like to picture Krishna or Vishnu or Allah or Yahweh, whoever works for you. And you picture God in your heart. Within God is what? The entire creation. Everybody. So if you can picture God in your heart and you know that everything and everybody is within the heart of God, then you can make this transition into appreciating all these people, because they're not projected out around you. They're contained within you because they're within God's heart. That's the best explanation of it I've ever seen, or that's ever been presented to me. Because that doesn't, I mean, it seems like it would be relatively easy to do that, as opposed to projecting your mind to a group outside of yourself that you don't like. So this way it puts it all within you, puts the entire creation within you. And if you have a relationship with God and you can develop love for God, then it's, I think, more easy to develop compassion for everything that is within him. In the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, I am in everyone and everyone is in me. Which, of course, is one of those great confounding statements. I am in everyone and everyone's in me. Well, what do you mean? Well, you know what he means. Nothing could live for a second without God being in us, sustaining even this carpet.
So without
personality, you can't really have true diversity.
Personality
helps
you to have diversity, true diversity.
But I'm saying, I'm calling the three levels energy, diversity, and personality. Mm-hmm. But yes, the diversity may or may not have personality. I mean, diversity can mean the forest and the mountains and the rivers and the rocks and the grass. That's diversity. There's not a lot of personality in those things. Well, he could argue with me and tell me that an oak tree has a certain personality and a cedar has a different one. Yeah, but you know what I mean. Personality, diversity is that God is manifested in so many different kinds of manifestations. So we should be able to see God in all of this creation around ourselves. You know, in a pantheistic type of approach. Another one of the verses in Bhagavad Gita is Vina Vidya Vinaya Sampane Brahmane Gavihastani Shuni Chava Shvapake Chav Pandita Samadarshina. That a wise person, an enlightened soul, sees everything with equal vision. An elephant, a cow, a sage, a rock, and a lump of gold. They're all the same. Well, they're not all the same in terms of the diversity, but in terms of their value as energies of God, they're all the same. And one looks upon them the same. One doesn't assign a higher value to one. Oh, yeah, and the other one was the dog eater, which is a chandala. In other words, a very low class, an outcast person. And shvapacha means a dog cooker in Sanskrit. Somebody who eats dogs, you know, which is quite popular in some of the Oriental cultures. Yeah, well, this is it. There's no discretion. You have to have discretion when it comes to what you put in your mouth. Anyway, see, we're making a value judgment here, busily making a value judgment. But enlightened soul, doesn't matter. It's all the same. It's all some manifestation of God. So one sees with equal vision. You see the ego. I mean, you see what level a person's on. You do this all day long, every day. We all do. Mm-hmm. I mean, if there's two drunks walking down the street causing mayhem, what you do is you cross the street and you go over there and you don't bother even looking at them. Now, there's a value judgment. You just don't want to get involved with whatever that is that's going on there. They're obviously in ego, but they're in also in a form of, they're in tamas. They're in the mode of ignorance. They're in a form of darkness. So you don't want to get involved in it.
Yeah,
but they're also spirit souls.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying. It's we can see those thoughts, but we're wasting. But they're in tamas, and there's that recognition of all of those other layers around them to their true soul, even though you know that there is God within them. But the person living in the highest form of consciousness would look at all of that person as God or not.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. He would, but that doesn't mean he would engage them.
Right.
He may also cross the street.
Is it more that they...
It's more like this. Let me explain. See, you, if you saw a wise man, a Brahmin, an elephant, a cow, a real low-born man, a dog eater, a rock, and a lump of gold, which one do you want?
Gold.
Okay, so you see, different people might want different things. A lot of people are going to say, well, I'll take the gold. Because the gold is money, it's wealth. But you see, the pundit, the wise man, doesn't care for the gold. The gold has no special attraction for him, any more than any of the others. other things do. That's the way to, there. That's how you need to look at it. You're not attracted to one and repulsed by the other. He's neither attracted nor repulsed by any of them.
Okay, so is that not more about just non-judgment?
Yes.
How do you train yourself to be?
You stop making value judgments.
Because I know, if I chose rock, I'd be like so disappointed. So it's like, how do I train myself not to be disappointed if I took the rock?
You take the whole lot.
I'm like, Jesus God, if I have to get that level, I'm going to be back a thousand more lives. What's the fastest? The fastest way is devotion. So you don't have to do any of that if you're devoted.
Correct.
Correct. You can bypass a whole lot of it.
Yeah.
By just devoting everything to God.
Correct. Well said. You got it.
I'm only just finishing him back up his feet again, and that's what it's
and that's what we're going to read. So in the Bhagavad Gita, we all know, or most of us know, that it is conversation between Krishna and Arjuna. Krishna being manifestation of God on earth and incarnation. And Arjuna being a Kshatriya. Kshatriya in Sanskrit means a protector. He's there to protect kings. Not modern day, there's not so many kings around these days. There's even fewer good ones. So nowadays we have politicians and governmental leaders that serve this function. Some of them are elected, some of them are tyrants and dictators. There's all different kinds available. All of their job is to protect the citizens. Police, the army, the fire department, search and rescue, Coast Guard. These are all examples of Kshatriyas, people who would risk their lives, in some cases, risk their lives on behalf of others, on behalf of the common people, and see to the welfare of the people. That's their job. So Arjuna was one of those. They also have to be warriors. They can't not be warriors, as protection means doing whatever is required. So nowadays they may not all be warriors, but they would have a police force or an army of some kind, or they would have the bouncer at the door of the nightclub, and he would serve the same function. He would be the Kshatriya. So we have the Pandavas on one side of the battlefield, and we have the Kauravas on the other. They're cousins. The Kauravas have usurped the Pandavas' kingdom unrightfully, and the Pandavas have asked them to return the kingdom. There was a gambling match, and again, Kshatriya code is, if somebody challenges you, you got to take up the challenge. The bet was, whoever wins this throw of the dice, the other side goes to the forest for 12 years. Exile. And the 13th year, you have to live incognito. And if you're found out, you stay for another 12 years. In the meantime, the other party who won the dice toss gets to keep your kingdom and do with it what they will. Each had a kingdom. But the Pandavas' kingdom was vast. And the core of his kingdom was small. They were cousins, so they had, what shall we call it, fraternal competition. You know, they like to beat each other. Kshatriyas like to win at games. Very common.
They like the football, would that be Kshatriyas?
Football and these games, those guys are Kshatriyas. It's a Kshatriya nature, these kinds of sports. They're not protecting anybody, but it's the same warrior nature. And they're rough and tough and rugged and, you know, it's very machismo, manly stuff. So, the Kauravas put forth this guy, Shakuni, to play the dice. And this guy is a known cheat. You know, he's like a card sharp, only dice. So he wins. He wins by cheating. Everybody knows he cheated, but they can't prove that he cheated, you know, etc. So the Pandavas, sort of the good guys, are consigned to the forest in exile for 12 years, 13th year added on.
Do they try and kill them all while they're out in their 12 years?
They do, yeah. Well, actually, they had done that earlier in time. There's this lifelong rivalry between the cousins. So, the 13 years is over. They come back and they say, return our kingdom. And Duryodhana, who is the wicked cousin, he says, yeah, over my dead body type of thing. And he says, well, and then Krishna gets involved, but Krishna gets involved more as a diplomat. Peacemaker, trying to broker a deal. Well, give them each, the five brothers, the Pandavas, give them each a village. Give them each a city. No, no cities. Give them each a village. No villages. Nothing. Well, it was their kingdom to begin with. So now all the pacification and peacemaking is to no avail. All the diplomacy doesn't work. So now we're at the point where the Pandavas have seven Akshauhinis of soldiers. Akshauhini is a division, but we're talking about hundreds of thousands in one Akshauhini. And they have foot soldiers, they have horses, chariots, and elephants. That's the four limbs of their army. They have seven, and the Kauravas, the bad guys, have 11 Akshauhinis. They're almost outnumbered 2-1, not quite. But the Pandavas have Krishna. Is Krishna fighting? No. He's driving Arjuna's chariot. But he said, I won't fight. If you want, I'll drive your chariot. So the beautiful metaphor here is, get God to drive your chariot. And everything will be fine. And driving your chariot means whatever it is you're doing in life, get God to drive your chariot, or the chariot of the body. So Arjuna says to Krishna, O infallible one, please draw my chariot between the two armies so that I may see who is present here, who is desirous of fighting and with whom I must contend in this great battle attempt. Let's see who's come. So a lone chariot comes out. We're talking about probably miles of the front line of the battle. So many of them there. You know, in the millions. And that lone chariot comes out. goes through the middle of the two armies. Senayor ubayor madye ratam stapaya mejita yavad etan niriksheham yodhu kaman avastitan kairmaya sahayodhavyam asmin rana samudyame. So then he brings the chariot in between and he finds out, what does Arjuna find out? Who's on the other side? All the relatives. Grandfather. His guru taught him how to fight. His weapons and arms guru. Cousins, friends, uncles, nephews. And he becomes disillusioned. What am I doing? Then he starts presenting arguments to Krishna. He says, no, Krishna, you know, I'm not going to fight. And he begins his various arguments. And one of them is, if I kill these guys, then their wives will be without husbands. Their sons will be without mothers. Their brothers will be without their sisters will be without brothers, etc. And the verse here is, when irreligion is prominent in the family, O Krishna, the women of the family become corrupt. And from the degradation of womanhood, O descendant of Vrishni, comes unwanted progeny. The point being, you kill off the menfolk, who's protecting the women? Who's looking after them? What does that mean? Women get preyed upon by men. This is pretty much universal. Men are always after women. And you know what they're after them for. Certain things, but one thing in particular. And even you saw in India one night you went to the Shiva temple, manless, and some guy was handing you. He probably wasn't after you for that, but he was after your money, or he probably was after whatever he could get. Anyway, that's a fact. So his argument here is, if they don't have men to protect them, then the women become corrupt. And from the degradation of womanhood comes unwanted progeny, unwanted population. Because women will then get impregnated, they'll get pregnant. They'll get raped in some cases. I read the other day. How many babies were born? Do you remember? I know. How many babies were born? 30 million in the last few years. I can't remember the number. In the U.S. we were reading. And over a period of like 5 years, I don't remember how many children were born. It was a lot. 40% were out of wedlock. 40% were largely unwanted children. You could say they were wanted, maybe in some cases they're common law relationships. But about half were, oops, I'm pregnant. And also, another statistic is 75% of the people that are in prisons have had no father figure in the childhood. There was no father figure, 75% in prison.
See, that's the thing. You see, girls are protected by the dad, and the boys are kept in line by the dad.
Yeah. And then, according to the Vedic system, a girl is given by the dad to the husband. Now, I've looked after and protected her up to this point. Now, you have agreed to take her as your wife, and you are agreeing to be responsible for her and look after her welfare out of love and her well-being. This is a perfect system. You could say, well, then a woman doesn't have her freedom. Well, she has her freedom if she's with people who love her. That's the kind of freedom. If she has her freedom and gets preyed upon by Tom, Dick, and Harry, then what is the value of her freedom? If no one's really looking after her and looking out for her. It's not about controlling her, it's about protecting her. That's the concept. Because as soon as you start talking like I'm talking now, you know, women's livers would be throwing stuff at me here. You know, the feminists would be at me. But I'm not trying to deny the women their autonomy. And he continues, when there is an increase of unwanted population, a hellish situation is created, both for the family and for those who destroy the family tradition. One of the first things they do when they invade, they did this in the Balkan War, is they kill the men, bury them all in a pit, and they rape all the women. And I don't know if they did this, no, I guess not in Northern Ireland, but in Northern Ireland they interbreed. One thing you do is you interbreed as quickly as possible. So that way when the children come out, they're both the invader and the resident. And it softens the mind against the invader.
The line is not so defined.
The line is not so defined. When you go up to the north and you ask them about the troubles, who's right and who's wrong, they all say, well, it's not quite that simple. That's how they talk about it, ones who live there. Because they know so many people that they like that have come from all these varying backgrounds. And they're friends and they're family members now, and they've coexisted for how many generations, and it's not that simple anymore. Same thing they're doing in Tibet. Interestingly, they have this Tibetan, anniversary of the takeover by the Chinese was 1959 or something. Yeah, this is 2009. So they have this now. But I watched the Chinese news channel and watched a documentary on Tibet given by China and their take on the situation and how all these peasants have been given their freedom to improve their lives, which was not possible under the old regime dominated by the aristocracy and the monks.
There were
5% of the people who were aristocracy and monks who ruled 95% of the others.
And
who were
people were just treated like dirt.
Were peons and peasants.
Like dirt.
Yeah.
Well, that's the Chinese interpretation.
I had heard it elsewhere.
But it was interesting to see it.
Of course they can interpret it that way because they want us to think that they have saved the country instead of
No, I'm just saying, you know, that's what they said. So, hellish situations is created both for the family, because they have no man protecting, no patriarch, and for those who destroy the family tradition because of negative karma. Right? So that's what he's arguing. That's what Arjuna's arguing at this point. Of course, Krishna, I'm not reading all the verses, but Krishna doesn't buy it. and he'll tell us why in a minute. Arjuna at one point says, you know, I think I should just go to the forest and meditate. And, you know, Krishna almost has to stop himself from laughing. You know, you're a warrior. What are you going to do? Put on a saffron robe and sit under a tree? Yeah. How long will you last? One morning? you got too much of the mode of passion coursing through your veins. You need to go out there and achieve some objective. You know, you've got to go do something and go help somebody or save somebody or administrate something. Start a project. You know. So finally, Krishna says to him, "Give up such petty weakness of heart and arise, O chastiser of the enemy." He calls me, gives him the pep talk here. Kshudram Radaya Daurbalyam Chaktvatishta Parantapa. Parantapa means chastiser of the enemy. So he tells him, look, you're being weak. You're being weak hearted. That doesn't convince Arjuna. Now he gives his very, very famous statement. He says, "Now I am confused about my duty and have lost all composure due to weakness. In this condition, I am asking you to tell me clearly what is best for me. Now I am your disciple and a soul surrendered unto you. Please instruct me." At this point, his bow and his quiver of arrows have dropped from his hands onto the floor of the chariot. He's overwhelmed. He's overcome. He's overwrought. His mouth is dry. He's perspiring. His knees are weak. And he's absolutely confused. How perfect. Because this is an ideal situation in which to surrender. As long as you think you know something, you think you'll have a way out. And the ego thinks it can use its way to manipulate its way out of things. But the ego is a very short-sighted individual and doesn't have a great perspective on things from your horizontal subjective point of view. You can't see from way up here where the light's brighter. Vertical. Like you can with self. So the ego is trying to, you know how the ego tries to talk you in and out of everything? So that's what's happening. Now he's surrendered. And he says, now I am your disciple and the soul surrendered unto you. Unless you're open and humble, you can't learn. It's not possible. When you go into a classroom, even as a child, you are, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed and innocent and pure, like a clean slate. And you sit there at your desk and you wait to get instructed from Miss Graham. I like her. Hopefully you liked her. In fact, that was my first grade teacher. I didn't think that was where that name came from. And you can be taught because you have the right attitude. You're open, you're humble, and you listen. Look at the same student in high school and see if the attitude's the same. So then Krishna begins to explain the yoga system. And he says to Arjuna at one point, he says, "Well, speaking learned words, you are mourning for what is not worthy of grief." He was arguing, Arjuna, about killing these Kauravas, relatives. I'm going to kill them and they're going to be dead. And so now Krishna begins to tell him the difference between the body and the soul. "While speaking learned words, you're mourning for that which is not worthy of grief. Those who are wise lament neither for the living nor the dead." Does he say you shouldn't be compassionate? No. He doesn't say you shouldn't be compassionate. He says you shouldn't lament, throwing yourself on coffins and wailing and slapping hands. And you see it on the news. Lamenting for the living and the dead. Why shouldn't you lament for the living and the dead? Isn't he just being hard-hearted, this Krishna?
I know the whole point of this book is to talk about the three forms of yoga: jnana, karma yoga, and bhakti yoga. And but I have always struggled with why God would push someone towards war, because are we not trying to create peace around ourselves and around everyone? Do you know what I mean?
He's not pushing him toward war. He's pushing him toward his duty.
To standing up for himself.
Yeah. He's pushing him to do his duty. That's in this case, it's war. Because his duty, he's a warrior.
Right.
So your duty may be to get up in the morning, take the train into the city, mm-hmm. and show up at the office. Mm-hmm. That's your duty. Now, nobody gets killed. When you do your duty, it's a different kind of duty. You may say, "It's killing me." And you may say that a lot. But it depends what your duty is. His duty as a warrior is to fight a good fight or a just war. So it's not so much that he's warmongering as much, and what you need to know is Krishna did everything back and forth and back and forth to prevent this war. He did diplomacy, shuttle diplomacy. He tried everything to get these Kauravas to give the kingdom back, which they wouldn't do. So now as a warrior, his duty is to fight.
So in today's terms, the UN trying to stop America from going to war in Iraq. Is that, you know?
That's the duty of the UN.
The
UN's duty is to create peace and to prevent war. Mm-hmm. That's the duty of the UN, not to foment war. Mm-hmm. And the worst thing the UN is supposed to do is to institute sanctions against countries who are misbehaving. And say, okay, well, in this case, we're not going to ship any more elastic bands to your country. So there. Or whatever. That's the UN's duty.
So, in the case of America going to war with Iraq, would...
Well, that whole thing, I mean, you know...
behind it to start off with.
You know, that was a whole smoke and mirrors thing to begin with.
America would be the, what are they called, to come?
The aggressor. The protagonist.
The Bhagavad Gita, they are the, what's not the Pandavans, the other ones?
The Kauravas.
The Kauravas.
Well, it's not as simple when you see the guy like Saddam Hussein in power, and he did do a lot of things that he shouldn't have done. So, but that aside, they went to war based on a certain principle or a certain issue that didn't even turn out to be true. You know, this weapons of mass destruction.
And that wasn't even cover up. It was all.
Correct. It was all smoke and mirrors.
Yeah.
I think we can justifiably argue that there was the U.S. was not duty bound to go to this war. You know, if they what they said was, well, we're duty bound to fight terror because we were attacked in 9/11. Well, what's that got to do with Iraq? Nothing. Nothing really, you know. Well, there was a guy who was a cousin of a guy who knew a guy who knew one of those 9/11 guys. Oh, well, in that case, bring the troops in. You know.
Also, it's the nature of the earthly plan for all this shit to be going on. And you can't possibly have heaven here.
This kind of stuff happens all the time in the material world.
The playing field for people to work out their karma.
Because everything here is duality. Push, pull, attraction, repulsion, good, bad, black, white, right, wrong, fat, thin, beautiful, ugly, poor, rich, winner, loser. That's what happens here. And no matter how much they say they're going to end war, it'll never end. No matter how much they say they're going to end hunger, it'll never end. Never. Why? Because there's thousands and millions of souls coming in to play their karma out through starvation, drought, war, and all these other diseases. We're going to get rid of breast cancer for once and for all. Good luck. Shouldn't we try to get rid of breast cancer? Of course we should. We should do it through enlightenment. And we should help those. Of course we should. But don't think that you're going to wipe out breast cancer when there's a soul coming in to get breast cancer.
What? So what happens? Everyone's just born and reborn and reborn and reborn for the next 15,000 years until the Iron Age is done, and then we're all back in the Golden Age, and the cycle repeats.
Yeah, and the Golden Age, there's less of the darkness and the crap that goes on in the Iron Age.
Is the Golden Age coexisting with the Iron Age in another realm?
Not that I know of, but, you know, you're welcome to enjoy that theory, if you like.
You can consider it heavenly planets as experience the Golden Age.
Well, the heavenly planets are always in the Golden Age.
Yeah, that's what she's saying.
Wow, heavenly planets.
Heavenly planets are where you go for your reward in the material world. And it's supposed to be absolutely phenomenal.
So that's where they get the whole idea of heaven from.
That's heaven. That's heaven, but it comes to an end.
And you're reborn.
And you come back down. The way it works is when you accumulate good merits, then you go and you enjoy, you cash in your good merits. That's heaven. And you go and you enjoy for thousands of years all these heavenly delights with heavenly characters and women who are absolutely stunningly beautiful and men who are gorgeous, and you can have sex as much as you like and you don't have to get pregnant and there's no disease and you can eat till you can't eat. Well, you, in fact, you can eat and eat and eat and keep eating and there's no negative result. It's all the sensory pleasures that here there's a limit on.
What's
for
the point in trying to practice non-attachment if you're just gonna?
Because you're just gonna keep going on that wheel and coming back. To practice non-attachment means you get off the wheel of samsara, repeated birth and death. When have you had enough, you know? How many times can you ride the Ferris wheel? Until you say, that's enough. But this Ferris wheel is painted red. This is a nice Ferris wheel. And look at the girl in the car behind you. I gotta just ride this one more time. You know.
What if I say,
no, you can't. No.
It's really important because I went to a documentary on global warming on Friday, and then I saw a global warming movie on Saturday, and I'm all freaked out about global warming.
Okay, Dr. Marcus Shmika, who's coming on the 27th, to give us more instruction on Vastu and how to increase wealth in your home. Mm-hmm. He says, and I'm not saying he's right, but I have a lot of respect for him. Mm-hmm. He's a physicist by training. He says all the major scientists say there's no global warming. Yeah. It's just one of their, it's just a myth.
New concoction, so it's a
biological. So we can get sucked into, you know, remember Y2K?
Yes.
Do you remember that? Do you know how much money they spent on preventing Y2K?
Yeah.
Hundreds of millions. Mm. Because the planes are going to fall from the sky and all these terrible things are going to happen. What happened? Mm. Nada. Nothing happened.
Loads of overtime.
So he says that there's no global warming.
So who's Mecca? So the day after tomorrow isn't going to happen. I'm going to have to run up to my neighbors and go, I'm going to hide down here in the storm.
You know, I have to tell you, I was real dubious about the Y2K thing, but I did go out and buy a propane stove. I didn't stock up on a bunch of food, but I did buy a I had a few cans in the cupboard, but I did buy a propane stove, a camping stove, you know.
But the way
they sucked me in to the tune of $15. And my son said, gee, Dad, this is great. Can I have this? I said, yep.
But, I mean, it's no made up story that the Antarctic is nothing.
No, but you see, but what the scientists are saying, and I'm not trying to say who's right and who's wrong, okay? I'm just telling you the other side. The scientists are saying, yeah, but that happens. It's happened before, and you know.
Look at the ice age.
Look at the ice age.
It's just cycles. That goes through these things.
Anyway,
and of course, us pumping carbon dioxide, I think
you know, our behavior needs to be changed and curtailed. No question about that. Okay, so Krishna then said, never was there a time when I did not exist, nor you, nor all of these kings, nor in the future shall any of us cease to be. So we're all eternal. That's what he's telling them. So he's saying, take a chill pill, Bill. Then he says, as the embodied soul continually passes in this body from boyhood to youth to old age, the soul similarly passes into another body at death. The self-realized soul is not bewildered by such a change. O son of Kunti, that is Arjuna's mother. What's with the light show here? The non-permanent appearance of happiness and distress and their disappearance in due course are like the appearance and disappearance of winter and summer seasons. Shanae. They arise from sense perception alone, and one must learn to tolerate them without being disturbed. Matra sparshas dukanteya shitoshna sukadukada agama paino nityas tongues to dikshaspa bharata. Simply learn to tolerate and don't let it bother you. Y2K, 2012, global warming, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Stay focused. What will be, will be.
What's that line that you read there? Out of self, out of sense, something or other? Just read it again.
Out of sense perception.
What's
it means all this stuff happening around us. You know, I read today, you know how they talk about, we always talk about the creation, the three forces of nature, creation, maintenance, and destruction. Right? Brahma, Vishnu, Shiva. But this one said, they didn't say creation, they said projection, maintenance, and destruction. Because it's not a creation, it's a projection. It's an idea that's projected into this matter and it appears. But it's only a projection because it's temporary and it gets drawn back up. As it's breathed out into existence, it's projected out. Vishnu's dream, and as he's lying on the causal ocean, on the serpent couch, and he dreams and projects this out and then draws it back into himself at the time of the pralaya, the destruction, the ending of creation, when it goes back into the state of suspension. What's the other word? No, dormancy. Right? It's called winter. All of those plants, they lose all of their leaves. They look dead. In fact, a lot of times you don't know whether they are dead or not. And then this wonderful thing happens. It's called spring. Do you see it out? No. Do you see the force that comes? No. You know, somebody knocking the door, hi, I'm spring. No. It's so subtle. It's almost imperceptible. And then there's this wee tiny little bud right on the tree out there. Oh, the tree's budding. We looked at them today. Oh, yeah. Little fuzzy things opening up. Ah, this was white flowers last year. They're pink this year. What's going on? You know? Doesn't matter. There's nothing to worry about. Don't buy in to all this BS. Mm-hmm. All this fear mongering. You know, Bush, you know, I'll give Bush credit. There were no terrorist attacks in America while he was president. I'll give him credit for that. You know how much fear-mongering there's been in America since 9/11? I mean, it is OTT. It's just over the top. You know, and Obama's going to come and change it. He's same program, different guy. Just try to tolerate the non-permanent appearance of happiness and distress and their disappearance in due course. For they are like the winter and the summer seasons. They arise from sense perception. It is simply the projection of the creation. And if you identify with it, you believe it's real. If you believe it's real, you will believe it can affect you. And then Al Gore will make you quake in your boots. And then they'll give Al Gore a Nobel Prize. And now you know it must be real. Because he got the Nobel Prize. Clinton spent $100,000 lobbying the Nobel Committee to give him the Nobel Prize. He spent $100,000 taxpayer dollars so that he would get the Nobel Prize.
Mm-hmm.
For what? I don't know. Exactly. Maybe Monica knows. But somehow, the $100,000 wasn't enough. He couldn't fool them on that one.
True. I have a question. Because I always worry that if I come back again, or I'm going to be... I always feel for the people who are actually have to be are tortured, like by electricity or hot water, or strange sort of imagination. And I always go, what happens if our body, say, if I had to be like tortured, and like, how do you get your brain? How do you get your brain to go, no, this is not real, and it's like, ow, and they're chopping off your leg. It's like, what? That's.
Well, I think the best.
I do worry about that. I know.
Okay.
It's gone from crazy to really crazy. So, do you go into it? Do you translate? Does your brain transcend and you just try to focus on God when it's happening? It's like.
The first thing is this: if you entertain thoughts, you're more likely to create those scenarios in your reality.
So,
it's the first thing is don't entertain those thoughts. The reason those would be, even be in your mind, my dear, is
I'm watching the TV a lot.
Are you watching that kind of stuff?
Yeah.
Like what? Horror shows.
No, not really. I really like. I'm addicted to. No, not addicted. I really love. Do you know the whole Chase and Stefan thing? The guy, warrior guy, and he fights for good, and then there's the bad. But then, like.
Yeah, it's a movie.
I'm always watching those. I'm always for good, obviously.
Yeah, that's a movie.
Switch your mind.
Well, you have to understand that. You see, these things actually have a great effect on the mind. Unless you're strong enough of mind where they don't have an effect because you don't allow them to. But when you're vulnerable, overly sensitive, or weak-minded, they can have a tremendous negative effect. You know, I used to watch horror movies when I was a kid. Not more than anybody else, but, you know, like everybody else would. It'd get the crap scared out of me so I couldn't even sleep at night, you know. I was scared senseless. But I always thought it was cool because, I don't know. But then I realized when I became an adult and got into spirituality that it's really terrible watching that stuff.
Yeah.
Because you're filling your mind with all of this crap.
And really at night, so going into
especially. Mm-hmm. And when you're real, like Kalindi's real sensitive to these kinds of things. Mm-hmm. I mean, if there's something like that that's on the TV as we're flicking through, I wouldn't stay on it for a moment. You know, not even as a passing fancy, I'd flick by it. Because mm-hmm. I know what an impact it has on her.
Yeah.
And, you know, I tell my kids, I tell them the same thing, don't watch that crap.
I can't watch it anymore.
You shouldn't watch that. I mean,
even on the news, nothing like that is in any way getting at my nervous system. My whole entire being is like. You know.
See, if you want to go green, which we all should,
mm-hmm.
and preserve energy and be more conscious about our carbon footprint and the environment, all of that is motive goodness. That's sattva guna. That's a good thing. But if you're doing it out of fear and terror, then that's the mode of ignorance. If your motivation, it's the same actions, but your motivation is coming from fear and terror And you're going like, yeah, is it all going to swallow me up or whatever you're saying there?
No, well, actually,
and she's worried about torture, you know.
No, no.
She's not even a member of the secret police. As far as I know, maybe she is. You know? In which case, she should worry.
This makes me very compassionate, I think, about all those people who have suffered that. Well, I don't know, I just go, there are people who survived that and how.
Did I tell you about this client I had one time? He came to see me and he was going through some torment in his life. And I did his chart. Never had a chart done before. He's a doctor. He's a consultant. So for my American listeners, that is a specialist. And he specializes in a particular field of medicine. He's very highly placed at the hospital. And he said, I've been having these dreams for years about myself doing certain kind of stuff, and they're terrible. I'd like to get to the bottom of it. And I said, oh yes, no problem. We'll do a guided meditation. Then we'll go into past life. I'll take you right there. No problem. So we go in and we go right into that lifetime because it's, you know, right on the very edge of his conscious mind. Anyway, it's coming up regularly in dream. And he is the master of torture. That's who he is. He's the guy that they send guys to that no one can break. And they send them to him. And he breaks them all. No one can withstand his torture technique. And they all sing. That's his job. And he's known and feared in that lifetime. All right. What do you think his medical specialty is in this lifetime?
The heart surgeon.
Pain relief.
Oh, wow.
His specialty is to take people out of pain. How do you like that? He is busy undoing what he did. And I'll bet you anything, some of those people coming to him were his patients in the last life, as they are in this life. The guy was blown away. He couldn't believe it. Yeah. So,
could you imagine?
Behave yourself. You'll be fine. Don't watch too much of that stuff.
Don't watch any of it.
Better you don't watch any of it.
Animal Planet.
Horse and Country. Discovery Channel. Well, no, there is sometimes, but, you know. David Attenborough, watch how the hornets are taking over the ants' nests. You know, this is a scary place, the material world. There aren't these battles and things like this in the spiritual world. There's no need for any of this. Because there's no contrariness. Everybody's in harmony with God. There's only one program. That's God's program. Everybody's on it. So there's no punishment. There's no war. There's no drought. There's no famine. There's no hellfire. There's no brimstone. And there's no torture. And there's no global warming. Okay, so let's do a little meditation. You don't like it? You don't like this key? It's electric tambour. Your drone. I had my there in Seattle. There was a blind woman who grew up blind, and she used to go to the forest and walk through the forest. Grew up near the forest, and she began to hear music. And she's a keyboard player, pianist. And she began to hear the music around people. And so you'd go see her in a little group. And you'd tell her your name, and she'd tune into you, and she'd find your key. Everybody had a key. My key, oops. My key was G. And then she'd play your music. And you know, there were people that we were there with that we knew very well, and some we didn't know at all. It was absolutely fascinating what this woman would do.
Muscle test herself sometimes to figure out
what's your key. So that's how I learned my key was G. And yeah, it's pretty neat.
Because that resonates much better than me. The other one was making me all wobbly.
Yeah.
Close your eyes, breathe, relax, let go. Deeply relax. Allow the stress, tension, fear, and apprehension to drain from your body totally, completely relax. Breathe and let go. Deeply relax. All right. You're sitting in a clearing, small clearing in the forest. A fairly thick forest. And the sunbeams are piercing through the trees and coming down on the sunbeams are all the souls in all of creation, tiny, tiny specks making up the sunbeam are all of these beings, these millions upon millions of souls. And it's all being projected, the sunbeam, onto you, to your heart. The beam is shining on your heart. And it's penetrating you. It's going into your body, through your heart, and out your back, and down to touch the ground. So the beam is going right through you. Feel that. All the beings in all of creation are traveling through you. They keep traveling. They keep coming down the beam, entering through your heart and going out the other end. And your heart is open and it's peaceful and it's trusting. And it's loving. And it's compassionate. Now, if you think about it, you know that there are some of these little specks, these little beings, these little souls, who are downright nasty people, not good spirits, self-motivated, egocentric, controlling, selfish. But even though some of them are like that, it doesn't matter to you. It doesn't really seem to matter, because they're so insignificant. And in the scheme of things, with the millions of others that are passing through you, you know, thousands at a time, it doesn't matter. Whatever those negative souls are doing, it really doesn't matter in the larger picture, in the greater perspective. It doesn't matter. So all these souls are passing through you. Now, slowly begin to look up the beam and follow the beam up, up through the trees, higher, higher into the sky, all the way up, up to the sun from whence it comes. Here is the representation, the eye of God. In the Purusha Sukta, this prayer about creation, the sun is considered to be the eye of the Creator. The eye of the projectionist, the projector. And this is where all of these souls are coming from. This is their source, their origin. Feel your relationship to the Creator. Here is the Creator and the creation. And all this creation is traveling through you, coming from the Creator. It doesn't diminish you at all. It doesn't add to you. It doesn't take anything away from you. It just is. It's just the creation from the Creator, and you're a part of it. Now, meditate on the Creator, on the sun. What is the message that you're given? What are you told? What is your duty? What is your role? What is your path? How do you feel about all those souls? Meditation here. If you're not yet finished, please continue until you are. If you're finished, please return to consciousness, awakening, feeling refreshed, relaxed, and at peace. meditation to the key of C. Meditation in the key of C. Creation, projection in the key of C. So, what'd you find out? I thought that was really cool meditation.
Yeah. Because in was kind of like Lakshmi Law Krishnaism, and out was Hekism was really so it was like, but it didn't seem to mind so much because they were all the same.
Exactly. Yeah. You see, even the troublemakers, they're so insignificant. In the face of creation, in the volume of creation, what are these few? You know, it's like a fly buzzing around.
Mm-hmm. I got a sense of looking at it from a human perspective, how much of a burden it is for God to sustain all that and not be put off by it. That was the feeling I got.
Well, it doesn't really, it's not a burden in the sense that he's got to expend a lot of energy. Is that what you mean?
But it's a huge responsibility.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
I really got that whole feeling of responsibility and actually almost feeling guilty for adding to all this mayhem. Mm-hmm. That's what I got out of it.
That's a good point. You're making him do this. In the same hymn, the Purusha Sukta, it says that, I've told you this before, that 3/4 of the total aggregate of God's energy is pure spiritual energy, and it's the spiritual worlds where there is no birth and death. 1/4 of it is like the cloud. That's the material creation that has to be maintained for us upstarts. Because if you don't have a pure heart, you can't live in the spiritual world. So he does have to, you know, he has to take those kinds of people and put them someplace else. In a classroom, if you got 1 or 2 that are creating a disturbance for everybody else, do you just pretend that everything's okay? If you're the teacher? No. You either put them in the corner, you send them to the principal, you put them out the door. Something. You have to. Because otherwise, it's disturbing the peace and the heavenly atmosphere that is the classroom. In harmony. When in harmony. So, God has to do the same thing. He just can't have the upstarts.
It's like running in a detention.
So it's running in the detention. That's what it is. My guru used to say over and over again, he says, this is not a wonderful place. This is a prison. You're trying to make yourself believe that this is such a wonderful place. It isn't. You know, you get diseased. You get a broken heart. You grow old. You die. Your family betrays you. Your friends betray you. All kinds of things happen here. How do you think this is a great place? This is prison. That's what this is. There's only one thought in the mind of a convict. What is it? When do I get out? Unless you're nuts and you think that, you know, you've gone to heaven. There's only a single thought. They all have it. How do I get out of here? That should be our single thought. Get out. Don't come back. Don't be subject to the Al Gores, the George Bushes, and the Bill Clintons of this world. All right. Thank you.
Om Tat Sat.
Hare Krishna.